All right, so as we remember, just some review. When we look at the Gospel of John, it's different from the Synoptics. And the Gospel of John is the Gospel of, what word? Belief or faith, right? And when we look at the Gospel of John, what we've been looking at is the whole purpose behind writing John's book and why he wrote what he did. And he says, these things were recorded so that you may believe, and in believing that you may have life. Now, when we picked up, when we left off last time, we had just finished, Jesus had discussed eternal life and this living water he has to offer to this Samaritan woman, which was very peculiar because Jewish men had nothing to do with Samaritans, much less a Samaritan woman. Now we're going to see that Jesus is going to have some interactions with another individual that Jewish men typically did not have correspondence with, and that is going to be a Roman centurion. And we've come to the second sign. We're going to cover the second and third sign of the seven in the Gospel of John today. And if you'll remember, what's the first sign in the Gospel of John? Water to wine. All right, number two is going to be healing the official son. And then number three is going to be healing the lame man, or it calls him something different in the text. It doesn't say lame. The ESV says invalid, but from what we know of him, it appears that he was incapable of moving himself, and so we'll just say lame. But those are the two signs we're going to cover today. As we begin this text, how we know this is likely referring to perhaps a Roman centurion or some kind of a guard is because of how it refers to this individual. It says that he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made water to wine. Now, before we get into this official, is Jesus going to be popular in this town? Why not? I mean, yes, of course he would. This is where Jesus performed his first miracle, okay? And he had turned the water into wine. People know who he is. They've witnessed his signs and his miracles. And many people probably witnessed this miracle firsthand. And so his fame has spread into the region surrounding. And it says that at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. Now, this term official, when you look at the term, bottom line, it's some kind of an officer generally associated with the military. And this would be very familiar to like the case that we see in the book of Luke, where the centurion approaches Jesus because he has a servant who is ill. We have Jesus' fame spreading not only to the Jewish community, but Jesus' fame is now spreading also to the Gentile community, to the Romans that are in those areas and who are in charge of these cities. And this official has a son who is sick, and when he hears that Jesus had come from Judea back into this area, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. I want you to notice this connection. This man is not Jewish, more than likely. He's a Roman Gentile. But he has heard of Jesus' fame. He's heard of the signs and the wonders he's able to do. And he has full conviction, full faith, that Jesus can heal his son. So as soon as Jesus comes into the area, he's going to send for Jesus to come to him. Now let's just think in that time period as a Jew. When a Roman centurion commanded a Jewish man to do something, what were you supposed to do? I mean, you absolutely do it, and if you did not, there could be punishment by law for not doing such a thing. And so this is kind of a peculiar situation because what this man is going to ask Jesus to do, it is not something that you would just ask anyone to do. He's asking him to perform a miracle. What if Jesus doesn't do it? What if he can't do it? Okay. Go ahead.
A Roman centurion is not really considered a royal official. They may be appointed over 100 soldiers, but my definition here that I have shows that this wasn't a royal official, probably directly under the king.
He probably worked for Herod the Great in some form or fashion.
Yeah, but not, I don't think, as a Roman centurion, but because the definition I have here that binds the Jews is that it's in a royal official. So he is a very high-statured individual in the Roman government.
Right. Well, and the reason we say that is all officials, royal or not, under the king, were over a portion of the military or over a general area. So if he wasn't a centurion, he would have been higher.
Yes.
And so it really wouldn't matter whether or not he was simply a centurion or higher than that. Bottom line is, this is a man of complete authority in a military standpoint over that area. Okay. But good. Now, when we look at this, this man is going to bid Jesus to come. And Jesus is going to speak to him, and it's really interesting how Jesus begins this dialogue with this man. And it seems that Jesus is not only addressing him, but he's addressing the crowd that is around him. And Jesus says the following. He says, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." Now, why would Jesus say something like that? Unless you see signs and wonders, you would not believe. Believe what?
Because of what transpired. So I think part of that there is that they want to see that. But he also knows that with their eyes they do not see and with their ears they do not hear. And so unless he does something like that, they would just not be moved to believe.
Okay. Okay. What else?
I'm going to take a stab at that. I think the nobleman was convinced Jesus could do it, because here he's a Gentile and, you know, he's going out of his way to approach this man Jesus. I think that statement was more for the Jews.
Okay.
That the Jews, unless they saw the signs, they weren't going to believe.
Now, okay.
I'll take a stab at that. But
okay.
I may not be right.
Okay. I saw one more hand, I thought. Maybe in the back. No? Okay. Jesus here is trying to bring up a point and a warning, because we're going to see this with the case of many who followed Jesus. They followed him only because of the signs that he was doing, but they completely missed what those signs were supposed to point someone to. This gets us back to the whole purpose of the book of John, and we have to look at each one of these miracles through the lens that John gives us. And again, looking at that verse, now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, he says, I suppose that the whole world itself could not contain the books that would be written. And then in verse 26, he goes on to say, but these things have been written so that you may believe in Jesus. Not that you would just witness these great miracles and follow them for what Jesus did, but the miracles were supposed to bring you to a conclusion, to an understanding. And these Jews and those around that area, oftentimes they would ask Jesus for a sign, but when Jesus did the sign, did they believe in the name of Jesus? Did they believe in his authority? No, they just demanded signs, and then despite the signs he did, they still did not accept where those signs came from and who he was. And so this is similar to the statement Jesus would make: an adulterous generation would ask for a sign, but only one sign would be given to you, and that is the sign of Jonah. We saw this earlier. This temple I will destroy, and in 3 days I'll raise it up again. Because they were demanding, you know, what authority do you have by which you do these things? What's the sign? That's after he cleansed the temple. Well, the authority he has, and we're going to really dig into it at the end of John chapter 5, is that directly of that which is divine. Jesus claims to be equal with the Father in John chapter 5, and we're going to look at that. But the official is going to respond to him, and he says, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Is he convinced that Jesus can heal his son?
Yes.
Absolutely. He believes that Jesus can heal his son. But now Jesus is going to test his faith, because he asked Jesus to physically come down so that he might, you know, put hands on his son or lay hands on his son before he dies. But notice Jesus' response. Jesus says, "Go, and your son will live." Does Jesus say he'll come with him? He gives him instructions. If you leave, if you just go home, your son is going to be alive. And so this royal official, it says, the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him, and he went on his way. He accepted Jesus' statement. And this should remind us of the actual centurion who had approached Jesus and asked him to heal his servant. And Jesus was actually going to go with him that time. And do you remember that man's response, the centurion? He says, I'm not worthy for you to enter into my house, but I am a man under authority as well. When I say to someone, go, he goes. When I say to someone, come, he comes. And so he says, just say the word and my servant will be healed. What this royal official had to do was come to that same kind of faith of which Jesus said of that centurion that I've never seen anything other like this in Israel, in all of Israel. This man had to come to the conclusion that Jesus was able to heal his son just by speaking the word. And so he believes it. He's on his way. He's convinced his son is going to live. And as he's going down, he's going back to Capernaum, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. And so he asked them what hour he began to get better. And they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. And the father knew that was the hour that Jesus had said to him, and your son will live. And he himself believed, and all of his household. Now this is the second sign that John did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. His servants meet him along the way, and they bring him this great news. And then he does some investigation. When did the fever leave him? Apparently he was sick to the point of death, some kind of a fever. And they said it was at the seventh hour. And this man knows that is the exact moment when Jesus said, go and your son will live. When Jesus spoke the word, immediately, 2 days' journey away, this man's son was completely healed of his disease and began the recovery process. And so let's ask this question again. We're supposed to look at these signs through the lens that John gives us. Why was this recorded? What does this teach us about Jesus? And what kind of things do you believe this man came to faith about regarding Jesus when he witnessed these things?
Well, again, it shows that Jesus has all power and authority and that he's sent from God.
Okay. Okay.
And with that being said, us as Christians, we can look at these kind of situations and understand, you know, God does not take it lightly when we enter into that covenant relationship with him and we become a child of God. And when we don't act right, God can discipline us. And he holds our very life within his hand. That should really cause us to really look at the ability in which God has to deal with us individually.
Okay.
And so when you see all of that, that's what this guy came to. He came to the knowledge and understanding. He had that respect and understood from Jesus' reputation that this would happen and that he could be his son could be healed. And he took it on faith, and Jesus tested his faith. And sure enough, now his faith has been proved. And he sees it was that very hour his whole family believed.
Okay.
That's so powerful.
Good. Bruce.
I was just going to say, it tells a non-Jew that there's a God out there that actually cares for him.
Yes.
All right, good. Hold on to that. We're going to come right back to that. Here, then here, then here.
It also shows that Jesus did it by himself. There wasn't any natural healing coming because he didn't go down to the kid and do anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Dad? Okay. All right, good. Wayne.
By this time, by the second sign, had Jesus proclaimed himself, or had anyone else proclaimed him, the Son of God, the Messiah, the Christ?
That happened earlier in the book of John. Upon Jesus' baptism, And that's what John says when the Father speaks out and says, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." And this same idea would have been brought to Nicodemus. No, that voice was audible for all to hear, it appears, at that moment. But John heard it as well. And go ahead.
I'm trying to figure out how this royal official, what he based his belief on. You know, where had he been taught as a Gentile about the Christ? And I don't doubt that he believed Jesus could do miracles, but to believe that he was the Son of God is another big leap. And I don't know how this royal official from Capernaum made that decision.
Okay, good question. Does anyone have a response to that?
He had told the Samaritan woman that he was the Messiah.
Okay.
So that probably has spread. And this is the second recorded miracle. It isn't necessarily the second miracle.
Right.
There may have been a large amount of signs that had already happened in that region. We just don't know.
Okay. There's a lot going on here, and this is why I wrote this out, and I want us to understand something else as well. Nicodemus came to the conclusion by that point that we know that you are a teacher of God, for no one can do these signs that you've done unless you were from God. And then when he speaks to the Samaritan woman, she says, and she's not a Jew, right? She's a Samaritan. She says, "The one who is coming, the Messiah, will tell us these things." And then Jesus told her, "I am the one." And that spreads in that region. News spreads fast around that area. This royal official obviously had heard by word of mouth of the miracles of Jesus. And as Romans, they were very familiar with the culture of the Jews, and they had to be, and that's why, also, you know, getting more detailed, the Sadducees were the ones that were very much in league with the Romans. The Romans always put Sadducees within positions of power among the Jews, and they were familiar with the teachings of the Jewish people. And so, obviously, this man had heard something about the Messiah. And let's just ask this on a standpoint. Why would the Romans be interested in one whom the Jews were talking about was a Messiah? Why would the Romans take interest in that? Exactly. Remember when Herod heard about this, that there was a king born? What did he send a decree out to be done when Jesus was born? Kill all the children. They're very interested in this prophecy. And this man comes to a different understanding of who Jesus is. Because Jesus is going to extend this grace upon even him and save his son. And I want us to recognize something about each of these individuals. Nicodemus was what kind of a man? He was a high Jewish official. The Samaritan woman. Oh, good job. She's from Samaria. She's a Samaritan. This royal official is what?
Roman,
which means he is a... Who is Jesus proclaiming the gospel and doing things for? All. Jesus' ministry, even though at first he was sent to the house of Israel, Jesus is still proclaiming the kingdom of God and preparing the way for all to come into his kingdom at this time period, which is really, really fascinating. And so we learn a couple of things about Jesus in this. Not only in the fact that you see this multicultural ministry, but one is his power over life. With turning the water to wine, we didn't see Jesus' power over life. We saw Jesus' power over elements, over, you know, created things as far as, you know, water and wine and those types of things. Here, Jesus has the power to save someone even from death who should have died. And yet, what's even more fascinating is the way in which Jesus created life. And I'm going to use that phrase specifically. Because there should have been death, and Jesus created life through what? Did he have to touch him? Did he have to, you know, and we see that all the time where Jesus chooses to touch someone sometimes. Jesus chooses, you know, to send someone to do some kind of a task. But in this case, Jesus says one word. He just says, go. And upon telling him to go, Jesus had already commanded this young man's fever to leave him, and it left him immediately. Life was born simply by the words of Jesus. Now, if you're a Jewish individual, or if you're this man, and perhaps you're familiar with the teachings of the Jews, as soon as you recognize Jesus creating life through words, what should this remind you of?
The word became life.
This should go all the way back to Genesis, because how did God create the world? Did he use his hands? He spoke it into existence. And when Jesus began speaking things into existence, we start to understand something about who Jesus is. And that's the faith this man came to, and it's similar to the centurion when he says, "I am a man of authority." He recognized where Jesus' authority came from. It came from the Father himself. And therefore, he knew as the Father created the world just through spoken word, Jesus could create life or do anything he desired simply by saying the word. Everything was under Christ's authority. Yes, Mick?
Don't you think that the leaders of Rome at this time became aware of what Jesus was doing?
Oh, absolutely. They're watching Jesus closely.
And they had an interest in this.
Yes, yes. And
mm-hmm. The other man took up his pallet and walked.
Right.
So he would get up and leave.
Right.
On your way. This kind of power has not been seen in the world.
Right.
That would get anybody's attention.
Right.
Some saw it as something great, some saw it as threat. That's humanity.
Right. Right. In Mark chapter 6, just to confirm what we had just decided there about, was Rome aware of this? When you get to Mark chapter 6, by the time Jesus sends out his 12 apostles, it says that King Herod had heard of it because Jesus' name had become known to him. And of course, Herod is put there to rule over that area as a political figure, but who is he under the rule of? He's under the rule of the Romans. You know, and so when you look at what's taking place at this time period, chronologically, they're aware of who Jesus is. They know what's going on. And they're amazed. Here we have a royal official who answers to Herod himself, who knew of Jesus. Herod certainly knew who Jesus was. The Romans certainly knew who Jesus was. I thought I saw one more hand up. Okay. We're going to now come to the second miracle. And we have to, for the sake of time, move on. Or the third miracle, excuse me. In this third miracle, we have some amount of a lapse of time, and we have no idea how much time that is. Because it says, after this, well, how much long after this? We have no idea. That there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, we have no idea which feast this was. There were a lot of feasts that took place where people went up to Jerusalem to participate in. So because this just says after this, there's really no great guess as to the time period in which this took place. But there's some type of feast taking place in Jerusalem. And it says that there was in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda. And there's all sorts of different spellings for that. Yours might say Bethsaida or something different, but the ESV translates this Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. And in these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. Now, this five roofed colonnades, I'll spare you and I won't draw on the board and create beautiful art for you. But really, actually, in excavating, these were two pools, just called one pool. And they found it. It's next to what is now the Cathedral of St. Anne over there. And this is one of the pillars that you still see standing there. And what a colonnade was this covered area. And so we're like these five covered areas. And there was a walk space between these two pools. And there was something going on with this pool at that time period. that they believed it had a lot of healing power to it. And they believed it by witness of what we see in the text. And I'll ask you, go ahead and read verse 4 in your Bibles. Where's verse 4? Is it not there? All right, notice that. It goes from verse 3 to verse 5. And that's because verse 4 is in some of the later manuscripts that we have, but it's not found in the earliest uncials that are the most accurate that we have. But this is what verse 4 says. It continues the end of verse 3. And these lay the multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred the water. And whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was healed, of whatever disease he had. They believed, and obviously there was something going on here, because we even have Roman records in the archaeological Bible. It cites the connection between the pool and the healing process is attested not only by the fourth gospel, but by archaeological remains indicating that Romans also sought healing there after taking over Jerusalem in approximately 135 AD. Even Gentile records say that Roman officials, when they were sick, went to this pool and tried to get in, and some of them noted that there was some kind of healing that took place. Whether this was of God or not, there's just absolutely no record of that or no evidence of that. But they believed it. That's what we need to understand for this text, is they believed that this pool had some healing powers to it that they attributed to God. And so you have all these men that are laying around waiting to be the first one to get in. Because if you're the first one to get in, once it gets stirred up, then you're healed, so they thought. And so one of these men that was there had been an invalid for 38 years. Now, we don't know how old this man is, but we understand later from something Jesus says in the text that he was not always this way. It appears that however he became invalid, it was because whatever he had done, he was either disciplined because of a sinful action to make him this way, or in doing something sinful that he had become this way. And we'll look at that later on in how Jesus speaks to him. But this man could be, you know, 48, 58. We just don't really know how old he is. But he's been sitting there next to this pool as often as he can. He's an invalid. He's been that way for 38 years. And Jesus is going to walk up to him and ask him a really peculiar question. Do you want to be healed? Now, what kind of a question is that? Do you want to be healed? Does that strike you as odd? Why would Jesus ask someone, do you want to be healed?
Well, it's a good leading question. I mean, it starts a conversation.
Okay, right. You know, he has perhaps no idea who Jesus is. You know, his response is, of course I want to be healed. And he's going to respond with not thinking that Jesus has the ability to do this, but in thinking the pool has the ability to do this, okay? So he asks him, do you want to be healed? And so I think part of it is he's setting him up to understand that the power to heal is not in this water, but it's in the power of Jesus Christ. Why else do you think he might ask him this question? Go ahead.
The scripture says that Jesus knew he'd been there a long time.
Okay.
Why are you sitting here? Do you
right.
want to be healed?
Now, I might be being speculative, and this is just my opinion. So, for the record, just my opinion. This man is going to make the claim. He says, sir, I have no one to put me into the pool. And when the water is stirred up, and while I'm going, another steps down before me. Now, let me ask this question. 38 years. You're telling me every single time he's tried to get into the water for 38 years, no one's ever helped him, and someone's always beat him out. I mean, that's certainly a possibility, but maybe there's another side to this. When you were in this kind of a condition, could you work?
No.
Could you take care of yourself? But in doing so, who took care of you?
Somebody.
He was living off of handouts. And so it could be perhaps, given his condition and his situation, that he quite enjoyed being in the position he was because he had everything taken care of for him. A lot of people seem to be like that, not just in that culture, but in our culture today. How often do people enjoy not, you know, claiming disability or not working when they could because everything's taken care of for them? Not everyone is that way, but some people abuse the system, don't they? It could be, and this is just my opinion, it could be that this man is abusing the system, and so Jesus is asking him, do you want to be healed? Do you actually want to be healed? That might not be the case. It could just be a leading question to understand who Jesus was. And so this man responds, I have no one to put me in. 38 years have gone by, and he's never been healed. Go ahead, Joanne. Go ahead.
One is, it doesn't say that he was by the pool for 38 years. It says he'd been an invalid for 38 years.
Correct.
Secondly, did I hear you correct that the reason he was an invalid was because of sin?
We're going to see that, and it's implied by what Jesus says in verse 14 later on. Because Jesus is, after healing him, he's going to say, see, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. Well, what does that imply? That he was sinful, and that it implies that nothing worse may happen to you, that the reason he was an invalid is somehow connected to something he had been doing previously that was sinful. That seems to be what Jesus is saying there. And so when we look at this, Jesus is going to offer him the healing that obviously he does want. And so my opinion about what it could be is probably not the case. It probably is the case that he wants to be healed. Jesus asks him this leading question. He thinks of the pool. Jesus is going to redirect his attention to himself. And so Jesus says to him, get up, take up your bed, and walk. And at once the man was healed. And he took up his bed and walked. And that's all that is recorded for us. He just gets up and he goes, just like the man who had been lowered down in the roof. And Jesus says, which is easier to say, your sins are forgiven, or rise, take up your bed and walk. And so the man gets up, takes up his bed and walks out of there. Same thing happens. Without getting into the pool, he's healed. Jesus just says the word again and the man is healed. Go ahead. Right.
You have no muscle structure, you have no ability to lift yourself up off the ground or walk or anything.
Right. This is no magic trick that's taking place here, okay? Jesus legitimately reconstructs this man from the inside out. Go ahead.
And with that, by Jesus doing this particular miracle, it would get message out about this pool and where the angel stirred up the water that Jesus was even greater than that.
Right. Okay.
And so that's a big point that would get out everywhere.
Good, good. We're going to get to that in just a second. Yeah, Bruce.
I was just going to say, it's an interesting human view, but Jesus asked, do you want to be healed? And he automatically goes into an excuse why he hasn't.
Right.
He doesn't answer yes or no.
Right.
He says, well, this is what's going on. And so many times we do the same thing.
Oh, good.
Instead of just looking at the question and saying yes or no, we find excuses or reasons why we can't be here on Sunday morning.
Right.
We can't.
And that's what had led me to just speculative about that other possibility is why does he give an excuse right away? Is it legitimate or is it an excuse? I just don't know. Yeah, Mick.
They already knew that Jesus had performed other miracles before they came to heal. And if they had knowledge of this and seen the results of what he had done already, then faith had to come in here someplace.
Okay.
First would be the father of the guy that was sick with the fever.
Right.
He's going to die.
Right.
He had to have a belief that Jesus could heal his son.
He didn't have to, but he did. Because in this case,
where did he get the faith?
Well, that's what I want to cover that real quick. Does it require faith for Jesus to heal you? Okay. In the other man's case, did Jesus make that a condition, though? So in his case, the answer is yes. He said, go, and your son will be well. And he believed Jesus, and it was so. Now, in this case, this man has no idea who Jesus is. He just tells him, get up and walk. And so he gets up and walks. What kind of faith did he have in Jesus? It doesn't record anything about his faith. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, he had to have faith that what Jesus was saying was the truth, or else he would have never tried to get up.
Okay, maybe, maybe. Okay, maybe. But that's all speculative. Okay, go ahead, Mick.
This is speculating. What about the young lady that just touched the hem of his garment?
Right, she believed. Okay. But to make the requirement that faith is necessary for a miracle to take place is not a biblical argument. And we need to understand that because a lot of times today, faith healers, why are they called faith healers? It's their caveat, because if it doesn't work, what's their automatic argument? Well, because you didn't believe enough. And so that's why you weren't healed. In which case did Jesus ever tell someone, this will happen to you, and it didn't happen, and Jesus said, well, it's because you didn't have enough faith? Never recorded. Never happened. Go ahead.
Well, when he turned the water into wine, all the wedding guests, it didn't require faith for them.
No faith required. It just took place. Right. Go ahead. Right. Right. Jesus spoke it into existence. He looks down and his legs are restored. It's just there. Go ahead, Anel.
With the argument that it doesn't require faith, he didn't go to Jesus and say, heal me. Jesus saw him and came to him.
That's right. That's right. And so that's why I put the, sometimes Jesus gives that as a condition, like with the official son. He told him, go and your son will be well. And as he goes, he believes. And Jesus had done it. But I want you to recognize that Jesus expected him to come to a moment of belief. But at what hour was his son healed? At the seventh hour. When Jesus said it, had he believed it yet? It said he believed it when? Jesus expected him to come to a moment of belief, and he did. But Jesus had healed his son before he even came to that moment, that realization. That's why we make the point that Jesus never made an individual's faith or belief a requirement for you have to have this great of faith in order for this miracle to work. Never took place. Go ahead.
If you fast forward to John 9, the blind man didn't even know who Jesus was. Back when he gets questioned, he goes, they said, who is this? He goes, I think he's a prophet. You know, he didn't know.
Right. Good.
He had no idea who Jesus was.
Good. Good. Now, here's what we need to recognize, because this is going to lead us in to the next section. When did Jesus do this miracle? On the Sabbath. Now, as good Bible students, is that going to be a big deal with the Jews,
yep,
with the Pharisees? Over and over again, this is what they're going to be upset about. And so I want you, this is just unbelievable. The Jews, this man's been invalid for 38 years. Do you think people know who he is? They know that he shouldn't be walking. And not because it's the Sabbath. They know he shouldn't be walking because he's an invalid. It would take a miracle for him to be walking again. And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, it's the Sabbath, and it's not lawful for you to take up your bed. Who told you you can get up and walk? How dare you? This is where this comes from. When you look at the Mishnah, remember Jesus told them that they taught as though it was the commandments of God, the traditions of men. When you look at the Mishnah, Shabbat 7.2, they have all these things you cannot do on the Sabbath. Sowing, plowing, reaping, binding sheaves, threshing, winnowing, sorting, grinding, sifting, kneading, baking, shearing wool, whitening it, combing it, dyeing it, spinning, weaving, making two loops, weaving two threads, separating two threads. Can't do that. That's work. Tying a knot, untying a knot. Sowing two stitches, tearing for the purpose of sowing two stitches, hunting a deer, slaughtering it, skinning it, salting it, curing its hide, scraping it, cutting it, writing two letters, erasing for the purpose of writing two letters, building, demolishing, extinguishing a flame, lighting a flame, striking one with a hammer, or striking with a hammer. You shouldn't strike anyone with a hammer either. Carrying from one domain to another. That's it right there. Carrying from one domain to another. What had he done on the Sabbath? What did Jesus tell him to do? Pick up your bed and walk. Oh, we don't care that you've been healed. We have a problem. You picked up your bed and you walked on the Sabbath. Was this part of the law? No. Go ahead.
On that day, if anybody did any of that stuff, would they be prosecuted?
Yeah, there would be severe disciplinary actions taken by the Pharisees because of what they interpreted the law to mean. But they bound on people all these requirements that were not a part of keeping the Sabbath. These were all man-made laws that they executed and that they put forward for the people. And so they come up to him and said, who told you, basically, that you can get up and walk? It's not lawful for you to take up your bed. It's a Sabbath day. And he answered and said, the man who healed me, that man said to me, take up your bed and walk. Now, who's he going to listen to? The man who healed him. And they asked, who is this man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? Now, the man who had been healed did not know who it was. He doesn't even know this was Jesus speaking to him. For Jesus had withdrawn and there was a crowd in the place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, see, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. That's where we understand it seems to be implied in this text, maybe not necessarily, but it seems to be implied that the reason for his invalidity, is that a word? It is now. Was because of something that he had done prior that was sinful or connected to his sinful activity. Okay? Go ahead.
I wanted to say about the water to wine thing. My husband always says there's two sides to every coin.
Okay.
Mary's faith was very great, his mother.
Right.
Because she said, before anything, just do anything he tells you.
Right.
You know, and a person's faith can be really strong, too. It can cover a lot.
Right.
You know,
good.
And so whether the whole room believes or not, that person's faith covered a multitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So there are those two sides to that. I'm not arguing
good.
What you're saying. I'm just saying that also is...
Good point. Joseph is a perfect example of that because, he was in Potiphar's house, right? And the whole household was blessed because of Joseph's faith. So good. We are out of time. We'll pick this up next week. But he's going to send the man away, and the Jews are going to start to seek to persecute Jesus because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. And Jesus' next statement is going to prepare us for verse 18. My Father is working until now, so I am working. And it's going to connect us to this, that Jesus was, in saying such a thing, attributing himself to the level of God. So we'll pick this up next week. Thank you so much.